Ireland. What makes someone Anglican is that not that you are self-defining yourself as an Anglican, or that you can put Episcopal or Anglican out on the sign out front, because neither word is copyrighted. Okay, I hope you all know, just in case you want to know, if you ever want to sue the Episcopal Church, if you try to name in the lawsuit the Episcopal Church, that entity does not exist legally in the United States. It's the name we all use, but the technical name of our church is the Domestic and Foreign Missionary Society. And so, sure enough, if you type in theepiscopalchurch.org or tec.org, you'll eventually get to us. But if you want to go directly to the Episcopal Church homepage, it's dfms.org, and it'll take you directly to the real one, okay? The Domestic and Foreign Missionary Society. So, the Anglican Communion, okay, was started by the Church of England, okay? And the first kind of official break was us, okay? When we broke away from the Church of England in 1776, all of a sudden, several things happened. First of all, the clergy are all called back to England because they're here on their nickel. Okay? They're paying the salary. So the clergy had to decide, are we going to be loyalists, or are we going to be defectors? If we're defectors, you better be in a large enough, wealthy enough church that they can pay your salary. Okay? And there were many churches, or many clergy, not hundreds, okay? Like when this happened, after the clergy were called back, for example, let me just use the Diocese of New York. After the Revolutionary War was over, and the clergy were called back, in 1779, there were 10 Episcopal priests in the state of New York. Okay? I don't know how many there were there before that, but I know after there were only 10. So, the first thing that had to happen was we need to create a culture, a governance, a set of laws and rules and guidelines. We need our own prayer book because we are tired of praying for the Queen. We got a president to pray for. Okay? And so the initial U.S. prayer book, 1776, okay, the first Episcopal prayer book was in 1792. So it didn't happen overnight, okay? And a part of the reason it didn't happen overnight is not only were the priests called back, but the bishops, the missionary bishops, were called back. Well, we have a huge problem in the Episcopal Church, in the Anglican Church, in the Anglican Communion. And that problem is that a part of our faith, a part of our theology is that you have to have a bishop to confirm. Are you aware that we are the only denomination on the face of the globe that still requires bishops to confirm?
Even the Catholic doesn't?
Even the Catholic. Your Catholic priest can confirm you. Okay? I see we have some other people sauntering in. So, because of that, okay, for example, here at St. David's, unless we just dream up building programs or other things like that, the bishop only comes once every 2 years. Okay? Good evening.
Can he come if he wants to come more?
He can come if he wants to come more. It will not be on a Sunday.
Oh, okay.
There's no reason you have to be confirmed on a Sunday. Okay?
Right.
But anyway, when we're talking about the Episcopal Church history, Anglican, we started a few minutes early because we weren't sure.
I'll be back.
Okay. But I'll recap for you quickly. Okay. But let's wait just a few more minutes, whatever time it is. You have any questions while we're waiting on folks?
Where did that original name come from?
Anglican?
The true name of the church.
Oh, the Domestic and Foreign Missionary Society was the name that we were incorporated under. And
doesn't help me.
Oh, okay. At the first general convention, which was held, anybody know? Philadelphia, three blocks from Independence Square. Okay. Many of the same people who were at the Revolutionary Congress and all of that sort of stuff, they left there and walked down the street and attended the church convention. Okay, because they knew they had to have a similar structure. When you look at the organizational structure of the Episcopal Church as opposed to the Church of England, you can tell that it was designed by the same group of people who designed the U.S. government. You have a Senate and you have a House of Representatives. We have a House of Bishops and we have a House of Deputies. Okay? Can legislation pass if only one house passes it? No. Okay? Do we have a president? Yes. Do we have a presiding bishop? Yes. Can the House of Bishops or the House of Deputies or the Senate or the House of Representatives override what the president says? Yes. And we have several times. The whole Constitution and canons of the Episcopal Church and the Constitution of the United States are amazingly similar in structure. And so, you know, while that's not necessarily a good thing, it's a good teaching tool. When they were deciding, okay, what the name of the church should be, we were in a very different culture, okay? They were rebelling against anything that looked English. So they're certainly not going to call it the Anglican Church, okay? Because it was off the table, okay? Similarly, to talk about the Episcopal Church in 1776 would have made absolutely no sense, because what if you were studying denominations, you would say there is the Episcopal style of church government, there is the congregational style of church government, and there's the Presbyterian or Presbytery related style of government. They thought about it more in that way than the name of a denomination. The word Episcopal is from the Greek word episkopos, which means bishop. We are a church of and governed by bishops. Okay? And so many of our practices, many of our understandings of things all go back to him. Okay? I am the rector of this parish, but I'm not the boss. The bishop can override anything I say. Okay? I am subject to him in all things. He does not like surprises. Not this one, not any bishop likes surprises. So when we talk about the Anglican Communion, okay, notice it says it has no international juridical organization. What does juridical mean? It's not judicial. What's juridical mean? There's no way that the church, whether it's the Archbishop of Canterbury or anything, okay, this will be a better way for you to understand it. The Roman Catholic Church is a juridical church. It has a pope. The pope can come in and say anything that he wants or she wants, right? Not anytime soon. Okay. But when something is juridical, it has power and authority over another, that is, even including a veto. Okay? So the Archbishop of Canterbury can say to the Episcopal Church, I don't like what you're doing, but there's no power to enforce change. Okay, the only power is we're not going to invite you to the next Lambeth Conference. We're not going to invite you to the next meeting. Or they can make recommendations, but there's nothing that's enforceable. There are perks and benefits that can be drawn back, but they can't kind of force things. The Archbishop of Canterbury's role is strictly symbolic and unifying in the communion. We have had archbishops of Canterbury that the Episcopal Church has been at odds with. So, what else is new? That's been the case for a couple hundred years. Okay? And the communion's three international bodies are consultative and collaborative. Okay? So they're there to find out what you're thinking, what you're doing, whatever, and to give you their opinion, their input, because hopefully, together, by the sharing of information and experience, you can come to what is orthodox, right teaching. So let me give you an example. In 1988, when the Lambeth Conference gathered together, they gathered together to, it wasn't 88, it would have been 77, because it was right before I was ordained. In 1977, they gathered, and the hot issue in the Anglican Communion, anybody guess, 1977?
Women priests.
Not yet. Not an issue. Wasn't the homosexuality issue, no. It was monogamy.
Oh,
monogamy.
Okay.
Oh,
monogamy. You mean we can only have one wife?
Yeah.
What do we do with the others? Because, okay, please understand, okay, when you and I use the word Anglican, immediately what pops into our mind is white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. Okay? The current connotation, numerically, of Anglican is black, sub-Saharan, African, significantly outnumbering. I mean, there are dioceses in Africa that have more Episcopalians who actually go to church on Sunday than we have in the entire United States. Okay? So when we look at, you know, kind of what makes us Anglican, okay, we have to have a standard, a certain body of understanding, thinking, talking, whatever, that we want to get people together. And let me tell you what happened. In 1977, bishops in Africa couldn't understand why monogamy was such an issue. You know, all the Westerners, all the U.S. bishops, okay, who in the past have basically said, and you can go back and do some research and you'll see I am really correct, Okay? You don't agree with us? We're not sending you any money. And so many parts of the Anglican Communion have been bullied into kind of, shall we say, a more progressive thinking until they got to the issue of sexuality. And that's when the African bishops, the sub-Saharan bishops, the bishops in the southern cone, basically south of the equator, said, we're done. Enough is enough. And now they are sending missionaries to America to try and win us back for Christ. Just wait. You'll meet some. It's coming. Okay? In 1977, they said, okay, the end of Lambeth Conference, here's our decision. Keep your two favorite wives. We're not going to say you have to have one, but keep your two favorites. The first one you're married to, the second one is your house servant. And then, of course, what do we do with the rest? And one of the African bishops said, I guess we send them out into the jungle to be eaten by lions. Mm-hmm. Okay, I want you to listen to the argument. Because while it is highly offensive to us in the United States, it made perfect sense. A very erudite, though unnamed, bishop stood up at Lambeth and said, I think that's the most unchristian thing I have ever heard. How dare you send your women out into the jungle to be eaten by lions? At which point, a very wise and very learned African bishop responded, you do it in America every day. You send your women out into the urban streets and ghettos. They have to fend for themselves amongst the pimps, and, you know, they become whores and drug addicts, and we think our way is much more humane. There was no final ruling on monogamy, but an incredibly interesting discussion. We tend to do that a lot in the Anglican Communion. We like to talk a lot, and discuss a lot, and think a lot, and be profound, but we don't make a lot of decisions. Because when we do make decisions, people get upset. Okay, so, yeah.
So what is it now?
There is no Anglican position on monogamy. No, there's not.
They wasted all that time.
It's left up to the individual diocese. Yes. Just as many things in this country are left up to the individual diocese. Okay? If you think there is uniformity across the Episcopal Church in the United States, I will guarantee you that is not the case. Okay? So, consultative and collaborative. Their resolutions have no legal effect on the autonomous provinces of the Communion. If you are self-supporting, okay? Do you remember, everybody remembers what the Episcopal Church flag looks like? White, blue field, red cross, 9 crosses, Jerusalem crosses, and they mean what? I'm sure you know. No. Okay, the 9 crosses represent the 9 provinces of the Episcopal Church. Okay? Anybody counted them lately? There's only 8. And that's why the logo of the church changed. Okay? You may not have caught that, but let me show you. Good old Google Images. Okay? Okay? Everybody seen this before? Okay, look at this one. Now look at this one. What do you notice? Oh, I'm sorry. See, some of the crosses are off the shield.
Right. Oh, so that's not... That's on purpose done that way.
This is on purpose.
Okay.
We still represent that, but Province 9, which was the Caribbean churches, basically said, you will not buy our votes anymore. We are going to become the independent Anglican churches of the Caribbean. So the only people that are left in Province 9 are the residents of South and Central America who agree with the Episcopal Church. Okay?
For the same reasons, because they're financially supported?
There is a reciprocity. They get a seat at General Convention. They get voice and vote, all of that stuff. The Caribbean Church no longer does.
So the only Anglican, the only Episcopal Church is in the United States?
No.
Oh, no. Okay.
No.
What are the others?
Okay. Can you hold that question? Because I have a list of them that we're going to get to at the end. Okay. Anyway, back here. Okay. Taken together, however, the four do function as instruments of communion. This is technical jargon. You have to be in a formal relationship with all four of the things I'm going to talk about right now. The first is the Archbishop of Canterbury. The Archbishop of Canterbury has to look at your church denomination and say, you're one of us. We don't say we're in communion with the Archbishop of Canterbury. He says to us, you're in communion with me. You see how that works? Okay. Functions as the spiritual head of the communion. He is the focus of unity, since no church claims membership in the communion without being in communion with him or her. Okay. Right now it's him. Okay. And the current Archbishop of Canterbury is a man by the name of Justin Welby. Okay? There are some people who say, why don't we pray for Justin, Archbishop of Canterbury? Well, we could. It would just make the prayers of the people longer than they already are. But we should and could. The second is the Lambeth Conference. First held in 1867, this is the largest group of international gatherings of the heads of the Episcopal Church, of the Anglican Communion. Now, yes, ma'am?
Is Lambeth a location?
Lambeth is a location in England. It's the name of a particular palace where they gather. Okay? And ridiculously expensive, okay, for our bishop to attend this last one, which was canceled. I'll talk to you about that in just a moment. It was canceled. We had budgeted for the 2 weeks and airfare $14,000. So you can imagine, if you're in a missionary jurisdiction, okay? Now, I want you to keep in mind that the average age of an Episcopal priest, a bishop, is in the 60s. So the likelihood that you're only going to be able to attend Lambeth once in your life is probably strong. So when you get an invitation, Lambeth is this coming year, I'm going to go, okay? Because that might be the only chance you live to attend one. So what has happened in the past is that the American bishops have outnumbered even the British bishops. Okay, because if you're a standing diocesan bishop, you get an invitation. If you're in a church that's in communion with Canterbury, with the Archbishop of Canterbury. So what's happened is in the past, we've just grossly outnumbered everybody, and we could pretty much call the shots. Okay, the Archbishop could veto them, but there was a strong American church presence When we get to what happened to the last one, one of the things that you'll see is it was canceled. And a part of the reason it was canceled, it's been held every 11 years since the Civil War times. Just as a coincidence, it had nothing to do with the Civil War. But since the 1860s was when Lambeth started, 60s, 70s, something like that. The reason it was canceled was because, first of all, there was a debate. Do y'all remember the UN debate? What's the table going to be shaped like and who's going to sit where? Okay. You see, our version of that is who's going to get invited? And if you invite so-and-so, we're not coming. And one of the hottest issues that the Archbishop of Canterbury had to deal with is Presiding Bishop Shorey was in, I want to choose my words carefully here, defiance of a request made by the Archbishop of Canterbury to postpone any additional ordinations of non-celibate gay clergy until after Lambeth. They said, we understand you did this with Jean Robinson. We got that. Please don't do that again until we can gather as a communion and deal with this subject. As soon as certain people in the Southern Cone, Africa, learned that Bishop Shorey was invited, even though she had defied that request of, again, remember, she has no power to order. It was just a request. Then there were a whole bunch of people who said, I'm not coming, you know, whatever. So the whole thing was scrapped. Now, technically, it was postponed. But you haven't heard anything about Lambeth invitations going out.
What year was it supposed to be?
Let's see, 68 and 11, 79, 90, 2001, 2012.
Yeah. How many bishops in the Episcopal Church in the United States? The eight? Is that?
Oh, in the whole United States?
Yes.
Oh, 186.
Okay, and they are all eligible to go to Lambeth for the once every 11 year meeting.
Correct. And the total, if everyone was invited, would be a little, I think about 500. And see, the 186 are currently active. If you've ever been a bishop, you're also invited.
Okay.
So there was lots more who could have. Okay, so do I get a invitation to come to Lambeth? The Archbishop has determined you're one of us. We want you there. We want your voice. We want your vote. Okay? International consultation. It's a forum of bishops of the communion to reinforce unity and collegiality through manifesting the episcopate, to discuss matters of mutual concern, and to pass resolutions intending to act as guideposts. It's held roughly every 10 years by invitation of the Archbishop of Canterbury. The third, this is very modern, first time it happened was 1971, and it's called the Anglican Consultative Council. It was created by the 1968 Lambeth Conference, and it meets every 3 years. They felt it was too long to wait to meet together every 10 or 11 years, so let's meet together every three. Council consists of representatives, bishop, clergy, and laity chosen by the 38 provinces. This is throughout the entire world. The body has a permanent secretariat. One person. This is a group of leaders who serve as the governing board. The Anglican Communion Office, of which the Archbishop of Canterbury is a president. Okay, so what does this group do? They try to work out the differences between the different Anglican bodies. So we know for some people their push-button issue was women ordained. We know for certain people the push-button issue was human trafficking. We know for certain people the issue was slavery. For some people it was sexuality. For, you know, a lot of people had their kind of project, pet project. Then, on top of that, let's have another meeting, okay? You may have recalled that we hardly ever use the word presiding bishop anymore. She has requested that she be called the primate or the metropolitan. Now, the primate has nothing to do with monkeys, but the primate is the head of a national church. Okay? The reason that sometimes she also likes to be called a metropolitan is if there are Greek Orthodox people there, that's the term they use, like an archbishop, the head honcho. Okay? So by saying, you will often see that she signs or is referred to as primate and metropolitan of the Episcopal Church. That's a part of the reason why. Primates meeting, first met in 1978, came out of this international consultation and deliberation. It was first convened by Donald Coggan, who was the Archbishop at the time. And this was a time to informally, not fight, not argue, not legislate, hang out. Leisurely thought, prayer, and deep consultation. And about that time, there was something that was brought into the church. You'll notice you've never heard me use this word. But they were called Indaba groups. An Indaba group was an informal gathering to do spiritual listening, to listen with your hearts and not just your ears. And these Indaba groups have popped up at various Episcopal and Anglican gatherings throughout the world. Some people think they're really cool and neat, and some people think they're a glorious waste of time. Okay, I've not ever been in one, so I'm not going to give you my opinion. But the result or the intention of the Indaba groups was not to push someone to agree with you, not to force agreement or legislation, but to say, I need for you to understand why I think and feel this way. Personal example. I've shared with some of you when we lost Michelle, there was a woman in Tucson, Arizona named Margaret Babcock who came alongside Lenora and ministered to her in a way that no man ever could. She was a mom. She was pregnant. She'd had a kid. She could wrap her head around what it would be like to lose a child. And when she came to minister to Lenora and pray with Lenora and cry with Lenora and me, you know, I'm just kind of sitting there looking. I've been in a diocese that didn't allow women to function. And I'm saying, oh my God, we wouldn't have made it through had it not been for Margaret. And so it was that personal, firsthand, very experiential encounter that completely reversed my brainwashing on the subject, because I went to a diocese that didn't allow women to function at all. Okay? The Indaba groups were kind of similar things like that. So, if you are a part of the Anglican Communion, you're invited to the primates meeting, you're invited to the Anglican Consultative Council, you're invited to Lambeth, you're recognized by the Archbishop of Canterbury. Okay? On your sheet, and I'm not going to go over them because it would be a glorious waste of time, but I've given you this list of all of these churches. Okay? Now, all of these churches use Anglican, Episcopal, Anglo-Catholic, Anglican, Christian, Episcopal. Okay. Not one of these churches is recognized by these four bodies. So they can call themselves Anglican till the cows come home. But the official list, and I'm going to leave it up there for you to see. It should be in the very front.
While you're looking for that, are they not recognized for theological reasons? Dogma.
Let me, just a second, Janie. There are many reasons they're not recognized. In some parts of the church, okay, there were some people who didn't like the new prayer book. Well, we're out of here. There were some people who, I hate the 1980 hymnal. We're not going to sing those songs, by golly. Nobody's going to make us, okay? For some people, they didn't like the inclusive language piece. For some people, they felt that the Episcopal Church was too staid and frozen, and they wanted to inject the charismatic gifts and all the demonstrable gifts of the Holy Spirit into the worship and liturgy. There were lots of different reasons, okay? One of the reasons, curiously, is that the Episcopal Church has one of the highest standards of education for clergy. If you don't have a undergraduate degree, you're not going to seminary. I don't care how called you are, go get a college degree. I don't care if you go to Tuag University, but you go get a college degree and then we'll talk. Okay? And you're going to go through some form of seminary. Okay? Now, I want to talk about seminary a little bit because this is a huge player in this discussion. We have 11 Episcopal seminaries. The largest of them in terms of graduating class is probably Virginia. And they will crank out between 50 and 70 people a year. Sewanee, where I went, cranks out 25 to 30 a year. If we were to take Neshota House, now Neshota's on the rebound right now, but 5 years ago they would crank out 10 a year. Okay? You're getting the kind of idea the numbers are like pretty small?
Yeah.
Okay. Now I'm going to compound it and say that if you graduate from an Episcopal seminary, within 10 years, half of your class will no longer be serving as a priest. You will no longer be employed by the church. And after 20 years, 75% of your class will no longer be serving in the Episcopal Church as a full-time paid employee.
And what causes that attrition?
Low salaries, very few jobs as assistants, at a time when most people who go into the priesthood in the Episcopal Church are older. So the time that they're coming to their highest financial needs in terms of their kids graduating from going to college, getting married, all of that sort of stuff, the wages will not sustain those high need income years. And we are one of the few mainline Christian denominations that do not financially support our seminarians. So you add all of those things together. It's nothing for clergy to get out and have $60,000 in student debt just from seminary. They add that on top of their student loan debt, and you know, you're in trouble. But anyway, so we have these 11 seminaries, and not all of those seminaries work to produce parish priests. Some do institutional chaplains for colleges, military, mental hospitals, or hospital chaplains. There are different styles and flavors. For example, when Matt graduated from general, do we have any cough drops over here?
I
have one. Do you have one? Des, you need a cough drop? Marilyn's got one.
Some pollen, I guess it'd be.
Well, I was hoping it wasn't me that was causing you to have the vapor.
Every word you say, Father.
Okay. So, for example, when I was in seminary, one of these groups, sent me a letter. We'll be happy to ordain you in the church tomorrow, in our church. And you can come be a, you know, crazy Episcopal clergyman in our denomination. You know, you have a calling, you've been passed by your bishop, and, you know, that's good enough for us. We'll ordain you right now. And some people took him up on it.
You wouldn't even have to finish?
No. Okay, now I'm going to go from preaching to Madeline. Over half of the clergy in this diocese have never set foot in an Episcopal seminary.
Really? You don't have to go to seminary.
No. You have to go to seminary. You don't have to go to an Episcopal seminary. Okay? So, one of the first things that Bishop Brewer did when he came is he nixed those two formal relationships that this diocese had with Asbury and Reformed Theological Seminary, both in Orlando, because this diocese would send people there. They could continue to work their jobs and do whatever, go to school at night. They weren't having, quote, the Episcopal Seminary experience, but they would learn something. And so when the bishop got here, one of the things that he realized is that many of the clergy in our diocese are not thinking, teaching, preaching Anglican Episcopal. They're Reformed clergy in Episcopal collars. So he cut that off. Yes?
There's been in our experience, a definite move of Roman Catholic priests in the Episcopal Church.
Absolutely.
And in fact, our former pastor, who is now a rector.
Right.
So they, of course, they've been through seminary, not an Episcopal seminary, though. Are they still accepted in collate, or is it changed by the diocese? It's a matter of
diocese by diocese, everybody does differently. But in this diocese, if someone came in as Roman Catholic clergy, they would have to be sponsored by a rector and a parish. They would go before the Commission on Ministry. They will probably have to go 1 year to an Episcopal seminary, and then they would be ordained sometime during that year in the Episcopal Church, so that when they graduated, they came out, they could step in to a church. But I also want you to know, it would work the same way with me, the reverse way. I could, within 6 months, be a Roman Catholic priest with my wife, not requiring celibacy, chastity, or poverty. I could be rector of a Roman Catholic Church Anglican Rite. Many Episcopalians don't know we have a church in the Vatican. Okay. There's the Episcopal Church Bishop of Europe, and there are smattering in Switzerland and France and all over creation. A lot of Episcopal churches. Okay. A part of the reason that I brought up the whole thing about seminary is that, for example, when the first church I was a rector, I went into the church and I all of a sudden noticed, do these people know what Episcopal is? Okay, there was an altar. There were no linens. There were no candles. There were no... And I'm kind of going, you know. And so I said to the head of the altar guild, do y'all like not have any Eucharistic candles? And she said, I don't know what that is. If you have a clergy person who is not trained in an Episcopal church, or in an Episcopal seminary, they are going to disseminate their ignorance of the tradition to the leadership and the members of the church. It will ultimately happen. You know how oftentimes I say, I don't want any little Scots running around here. I don't want you to think like me or act like me. God knows the church does not need any more people like me. You be who God intends you to be. I'm going to be who God intends me to be, and somehow I think we're all going to end up at the table fine. Okay. But I did go to an Episcopal seminary, but I want you to know that the more time goes on, the number of clergy that are retiring, okay, our diocese has a full-time clergy recruiter who is going to seminaries and other denominations trying to recruit clergy to come in to serve just the 88 congregations in our diocese. And if we were in the Diocese of Pennsylvania, one half of the churches would be staffed by retired clergy. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Okay. But I'm just saying to you that, and, you know, we don't have a lot of young clergy coming in because, for many of them, what do they know about the Episcopal Church? We know how to have knockdown, drag-out fights. See, they have a very different footing than do some of us who have been Episcopalians all of our life. So, while you had this massive list, okay, this is the official list of churches that are in communion with the Archbishop of Canterbury. They are invited to Lambeth. They are part of the Anglican Consultative Council. And they're invited to the primates meetings. And they are, basically, notice these are pretty much national churches. Okay? Anglican Church of Etruria, New Zealand, Polynesia. I'm not going to read the list, but I'll move it slowly. Every year, the Good Friday offering by canon goes to the Episcopal Church in Jerusalem in the Middle East. I went to seminary with a guy from Kenya. The Church of Nigeria is the largest in the world. Martin Bayang, who's going to be here next Wednesday, was originally in the Episcopal Church of the Philippines, in the Philippines. The Episcopal Church in Rwanda and Uganda have both taken major congregations out of the Episcopal Church U.S. There's Uganda. This is us, Episcopal Church in the United States of America. Okay. Then we have extra-provincial dioceses. These are dioceses that are in full communion with the Archbishop of Canterbury, but either because of their government or the canons of their local church diocese, they don't have the ability to have somebody like a presiding bishop or a primate or a metropolitan. So, for example, we all know what's going on in Cuba. It's no wonder that Cuba doesn't have an official representative because they wouldn't let him out of the country. Okay? We also have united or uniting churches. Most of these are in the same part of the world. There's also a whole group of churches that are called Old Catholic churches. And when I was in Lakeland, we actually helped start a guy in the Old Catholic Church. He was a part of the Catholic Diocese of the Old Catholics in Germany. When I was in college, our local Episcopal Church helped start a Polish National Catholic Church. Okay? None of these churches, old Catholic churches, or the churches that are tied through the Union of Utrecht, are in communion with the Roman Catholic Church, nor do they acknowledge the Pope. So although their name may be Catholic with a capital C, they're not Roman Catholic. For example, the Polish National Catholic Church, very interesting theology, not that dissimilar to ours, but there is absolutely no notion or concept of hell. It's just one of the little things I know about that church. The Philippine Independent Church, again, the Martoma Christian Sons of Thomas. This is the first kind of offshoot group. The oldest Christian denomination on the face of the earth. And then we have this other group of churches right here who have been grandfathered in by treaty. The church that they are in communion with is in communion with us. Do you remember several years ago, I don't know, 20 so years ago, we officially signed something that was called LARC, the Lutheran, Anglican, Roman Catholic, you know, Concordat, whatever it was. Okay, when we started dealing with the Lutherans, and you all know, if you we couldn't find an Episcopal priest, you could hire a Lutheran priest and he could come in and do our services, as well as I could go over to Ascension and celebrate if I didn't have to sing as much as Jay does. But we have full communion with those two churches. But although our polity is similar and we're in agreement on 8 zillion things, our major odd things that we were at odds over was ordination. Not ordination of non-celibate people. But it was, what is the essence of ordination? In the Anglican Communion, in the Roman Catholic Church, in many churches, they believe that when you are ordained to the diaconate or priesthood, there is an, I'm going to use a fancy word here, ontological change. There's something that happens within you that you're not quite ever the same again. It is a change of being. Okay? The Lutheran Church does not believe in ontological ordination. Their ordination is one of practice. So, very simply, Don is an ordained Lutheran pastor. He is unemployed for 3 years and one day. Oh, that was nice. Hi, mister. How are you doing? You're not reverend anymore. He's not ordained. If you don't use it, you lose it. Oh, okay. And so we had to, there was a huge debate. How are we going to accept them? How are they going to accept us when we vehemently disagree with their you don't use it, you lose it? If you are ordained to the priesthood, ordained to the diaconate, or ordained to the episcopacy, unless that is revoked or brought under discipline, what does the Bible say? You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek, the teacher of righteousness. Are those things lay people worry about? No, not at all. Okay, so that's the official list of all the churches that we're in communion with. All of the people on the list on your paper, the big jeopardy, no, we're not in communion with them. And although...
Anglican, but it has Anglican Catholic churches.
Doesn't matter. These are not churches that are... You see, links to Anglican provinces in North America, that's why I didn't give you two printouts. The list that you have, none of them are parts. Okay? So the Anglican Catholic Church of Canada is not the Anglican Church of Canada, nor is it the Catholic Church of Canada. It's a different group of people. And if you were to look up these groups, you'll see most of them started in the 60s or 70s or 80s. And most of them have very small numbers of people. They might have 4, 8, 16 congregations. They're not going to be large groups of people. Yes, ma'am.
When my mother was growing up in a small town in Oklahoma, mm-hmm. this would have been when she was born in 1915, she attended a Methodist Episcopal Church.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Now, would that be on this list here, probably?
No, it's not on that list. Okay, let me explain what happened. The Civil War was the Gordian knot in American Christendom. And basically what happened is you're either going to allow slavery or you're not going to allow slavery. If you allow slavery, you can stay. If you don't, you're out of here. Okay? And so if you go back to the primer is kind of the Anglican, or excuse me, the history of U.S. denominations. Okay? And you'll see 90% of the book started between 1835 and 1870. In the Episcopal Church, the continuing Episcopal Church, this was never an issue. The first Episcopal priest who was ordained, who was black, was a man by the name of Absalom Jones. I happen to always remember that because I was born on Absalom Jones Day, which is February 13th, okay? And his ordination took place, I think it was like 1813, 1831, it was long before the Civil War. It was not an issue. Slavery was not an issue in the Episcopal Church. Although many Episcopalians and Episcopal clergy owned slaves. Okay. Our church in West Virginia had a slave gallery when it was built. Okay. Anyway, it was not something that we fought over or that divided us. Okay. When the Civil War came, the Episcopal Church in the North continued to meet. They continued to meet for General Convention. When they got to the roll call of states, they called all the southern states, even though they knew nobody was there. There was a separate General Convention of the Episcopal Church of the Confederate States of America that was first called in 1861 and then again in 1864. After the Civil War was over, they never met, they never talked, they didn't disband. They all went back to the General Convention, and they were mentioned, they were welcomed, the roll call, the vote. Yeah, yeah, good to see you again. Okay, next. What's the first order of business? Okay, it was not an issue in our denomination, but in many it was. So, in the South, especially in rural communities, there was a dilemma. There were people who were really Episcopalians, but there were no Episcopal clergy nearby. Remember, Charles Wesley was what?
Methodist.
He was Methodist, ultimately, but what was he to start with? He was an Anglican clergyman who went to do missionary work in Georgia. And though started the Methodist Church, died an Episcopalian. He died a member of the Anglican Church. Okay. The move wasn't, we're going to start a new denomination. But the Methodist Episcopal Church started primarily in the South when the bishops got together and they said, we can't put a Methodist and an Episcopalian in your town. It's too little. So there's a lot of low church Anglican and Methodist liturgy, which is similar. You pull out the Methodist Book of Worship and you pull out morning prayer. There's not a whole lot of difference. Okay? And so the Methodist Episcopal Church started, but then there was another split during the time of slavery, and so you had the African Methodist Episcopal Church, the AME, and then there were people who were part of the AME Church who didn't feel that they stressed baptism enough. So they broke off again, and they started the AME Zion Church. Oh, okay. And so, you know, there's all of those kind of perturbations were predominantly attempts to unite churches in certain areas. Now, the same thing is happening in rural dioceses in the Episcopal Church today. For example, in Australia, you have something called the Uniting Church. And in the Uniting Church, you have certain areas where they are staffed by Episcopal clergy. You have certain places where they're staffed by Methodist clergy. You have certain places where they're staffed by Lutheran clergy. And then, when they die or retire or move, they get somebody else. And all of the people in that area who happen to belong to one of those churches, you come, and it is literally the uniting church. It's not an ecumenical church. They don't try to make everybody kind of think alike. But as the clergy change, there will be a different flavor in those uniting churches. And the important thing is we can't all support a clergy and a building and a ministry and whatever, so let's clump together because there's more that unites us than divides us. Okay, so that's where all of that came from. Marilyn.
I was confirmed in a Lutheran church.
Uh-huh.
And it was a Bethel Evangelical Lutheran church.
ELCA.
And I was under the Missouri Synod.
Okay, then you weren't part of the ELCA. You were part of the Missouri Synod. Okay.
Because my catechism book says Missouri Synod.
Right. Okay, so everybody knows there's the Wisconsin Synod, there's the Missouri Synod, And there's also the ELCA, which is the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America. Then there is also
that's
just the Lutheran Church. Yes.
That's what they changed. After I had grown up.
Okay.
I was confirmed, you know.
And we are not in communion with the Missouri Synod Lutherans. Okay. It was very interesting. Y'all may remember several years ago, we had a youth minister who was on the diocesan staff, not ordained, but he was Missouri Synod Lutheran. And it was very interesting. Great guy. He is now an Episcopal priest, but when he came on staff, he wasn't.
The difference between, I never knew what the difference was between Missouri and Wisconsin, other than what my grandmother said, that the Missouri Synod was more strict than the Wisconsin. But yet they were evangelical.
Yeah.
You know, I learned young.
Okay. But unfortunately, what most of us learned and learned young, we learned from clergy who didn't necessarily represent the denomination.
Yeah.
Okay, so.
Well, like 12 years old.
Yeah.
You know, I got more out of when Bob and I joined the Episcopal Church and we went to classes.
As you should. As you should. Okay. So, very, very quickly, I want us to look at some history pieces, because a lot of times we've talked about the Civil War, we've talked about this and that, okay? But I want you to understand that the fracturing, what I like to refer to as the fracturing in the Anglican Communion, did not come about because a hammer came up and hit it and it broke like a piece of china. Okay? What I'd like for you to think about is it's more like an erosion of a beach. It takes place a wave at a time. And there are certain things that where the waves brought in sand and did reparative work, and there were certain things. And so I've just given you a couple of things. Prior to 1944, there was no such thing as a presiding bishop. If we had a presiding bishop, they were a full-time diocesan bishop who took the mouthpiece after they were elected as the presiding bishop, but they stayed on as their diocesan bishop. This notion of, oh, we got elected to be presiding bishop, we get to move to New York, we have a fancy office and a penthouse apartment. I didn't say that. All of that started in 1944. And when that bishop was elected presiding bishop, they gave up their duties as diocesan bishop. So I want to be clear. 1944. You continued your role, your job as the bishop of a diocese, and you had this acting head responsibility, speaking between conventions, going to Lambeth, etc.
What caused them to make the change?
Adopting the CEO model of episcopacy. Yeah. Okay. Henry St. George Tucker became the first full-time presiding bishop. In 1958, 4 years after I was born, there was a coalition of church members. They were more liberal than the majority of the membership at the time. But they got a resolution passed, and this is what it said. The natural dignity and value of every man, of whatever color or race, is created in the image of God. It called Episcopalians to work together in charity and forbearance toward the establishment of full opportunities in fields of education, housing, employment, and public accommodations. In response, the Episcopal Society for Cultural and Racial Unity was founded in December 1959 in order to eliminate racial, ethnic, and class barriers within the Episcopal Church. Okay? I agree with all of that. But that was the first time there was ever a resolution drafted at a general convention that was really of a more social and political agenda. Okay? And, okay, now I want you all to hear out of the baptismal covenant one of the questions, and you will see where it comes from. Do you respect the dignity of every human being? See where that comes from? Same place. Okay? It was just a modernization of that language. Okay, now, do I think the church should be about all of those things? Absolutely. And I don't think it's a liberal or conservative agenda. But what happens, starting in the late 50s, is that the social agenda trumps the gospel agenda. It trumps the starting new churches. It trumps producing Christian education materials and Sunday school curriculum and all of those kind of things. We're not sending missionaries out. We're not doing... Okay, our focus becomes inner city, social ministry, social justice. And I'm saying all of that is good and I agree with it, okay? You'll see one of the triennial budgets, a third of the budget of the Episcopal Church addressed low-income housing in urban communities. Okay? In the 60s. In 1961, John Hines was elected presiding bishop. Strong social justice commitments, okay, elicit strong reactions from conservatives. The good thing is, at that age, I didn't know if I was liberal or conservative. Okay? My parents weren't strong enough churchmen that we ever were a part of the discussion. And frankly, they didn't care. But we can see that there begins to be a slightly different agenda. In 1964, the official name change by General Convention shifts from the Protestant Episcopal Church in the United States of America to the Episcopal Church. Y'all remember PECUSA? Well, there were some people who said, we really don't like that Protestant word out front because we're Anglo-Catholic. We really, and you know, it's not just in the United States, it's in the Caribbean, it's in Central and South America. You know, isn't that an affront to our folk? So the official name gets changed in 1964, as opposed to there, the Domestic and Foreign Missionary Society, which was incorporated in 1821. In 1967, there was a bishop who came in to implement what was called the General Convention Special Program, designed to redirect $9 million over a three-year period, a quarter of the church's operating budget at the time, to fund grants for community organizations and grassroots efforts facilitating black empowerment in America's urban ghettos. Okay, now... do I believe that in the late 60s the ghettos in urban America were pretty desolate places? And 50 years later they haven't changed. Okay. We keep throwing money at them and they don't change. And there were certain people, okay, at the time who were pushing a social agenda. And somehow the gospel starts to get lost. Okay? Now, that's not true everywhere. Okay? That was especially not true in southern Episcopal churches. And I'm talking about from the Mason-Dixon line south. I'm not talking deep south. Okay? But the church in New England, the church in Middle America, Chicago, the Wheat Belt, the church in the West has a very different flavor than the church in the South. Okay? In 1970 was the first time women were allowed to join the House of Deputies. Now, at that time, they were only lay people. They weren't women clergy. So if you were elected to be a General Convention deputy, prior to 1970, you had to be a man. Okay? Thank God that changed. Women could now be ordained as deacons. John Allen of Mississippi was elected the presiding bishop. First 11 women were ordained to the priesthood in Philadelphia. You may remember they were called the Philadelphia 11. Carter Haywood was one of the outspoken, one of the most outspoken people among them. I actually got to meet her when I was interviewing, going around. We went to Virginia Seminary, and she preached the week that we were there. Again, very impassioned sermon. The week we were there, Gerald Ford also worshipped at that church. And, you know, we had to go through the security and all that sort of stuff. And I will never forget sitting with my dear, sweet, very pregnant wife while we were looking at seminaries. And, you know, we're like, this is one of them that we've read about. You know, and she told her personal story, which was incredibly powerful. And then, so help me God, she said this. And, you know, I've served the church. I've done this. 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 And then she says, and because I don't have a penis, I can't serve the Episcopal Church as a priest. And I'm going, I don't believe I heard that word from the pulpit. And do you realize the president's here? I mean, you know, I was just horrified. I am a strong proponent. Huge issue. Are they irregular? Are they invalid? You know, whatever. Took us 2 years to figure that out. And the fabric was torn then, especially in south of the equator. Okay? Because you're primarily dealing with third world countries where women in no shape or fashion are seen as you and I hopefully see them here. In 1976, okay, General Convention approved the ordination of women, regularized the 74 and 75 ordinations. But, again, it was not mandated. So we had certain dioceses, like the Diocese of Eau Claire, the Diocese of Dallas, the Diocese of Central Florida, ours, the Diocese of Eau Claire. There were several dioceses throughout the country which said, we don't care what General Convention says, we are not going to ordain women. And if you are ordained in another diocese and you move to our state, you will not function. In 1976, there was a National Conference of Evangelicals for Historic Christianity. And they decided, you know, we've had enough. Let's get back to preaching the gospel and let's get in. You know, the church has become old and tired and frumpy, and it's the 70s. It was the kind of insurgence of the charismatic renewal. Let's start the Charismatic Episcopal Church. And it is alive and well in the United States today. Nowhere near as many congregations as we have, but the congregations they have are much larger than the average Episcopal church. In the mid-1970s, the whole issue of sexual orientation came into the news. Now, I want to be very clear with everyone. If you think that 1977 was the first time we ordained a gay clergy person, you are wrongly mistaken. Okay? There have been gay clergy in the church for hundreds and probably thousands of years. Okay? The issue was not don't ask, don't tell. We don't want to know either. What you do, I don't care, you know, move on. There were openly gay bishops that everyone knew about. Nobody said anything, okay? But when they start trying to get their partner named on the as a beneficiary in their life insurance, and as you know, it's not just the church that is struggling with these legal issues; it's the rest of society too. Okay, we just happen to air our laundry in public, so openly gay clergy people. First ordination, 1977, Alan Barrett. About this time, we approved the current prayer book. I want you to know, at this time, the membership of the Episcopal Church starts dropping like a rock. It's not just because of these issues. It's not just because of the social issues. It's because the age of the clergy. It's because we're producing no Sunday school material or education. It's because when we do have people who come in and start serving churches, many of them are ill-prepared or not properly mentored, you know, in the start of their jobs. And so what ends up happening... Good evening, Evelyn. Do you know where it is?
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. But that gets coupled with adopting the new prayer book, which was, again, poorly taught. We didn't prepare the congregations for it. And then it was kind of just like it or lump it. Okay. In the diocese I was in 1974, Lenore and I were married. Everybody else had seen the zebra book and the green book and the blue, you know, the blue book came out in 1975. They'd seen all of those. Well, I had seen them. I was an interested person, but not in church. You know, the priest would never have allowed their purchase. And, you know, when we were like, well, can we be married by the new prayer book? No. Okay. Well, this is the music we want for our service. If it's not in the 1940 hymnal, you're not using it. Okay. Okay. And then the priest who was supposed to marry us took a tour over to Israel, and the Seven-Day War broke out. And he was stuck over there for 3 months. So we had this old retired guy marry us, and as soon as he found out we were going to seminary, marriage counseling was over. It was crazy. So
it worked.
Thank you. Okay. So we have to stop because we're way over time. But what I want you to see is that these currents are all affecting the church. Okay? And we have an opportunity. And that is, okay, the Episcopal Church that I know and love and serve has said, you're liberal? Come on. You conservative? That's okay. You're charismatic? Just don't go too wild on us, you know? If you're going to raise your hands, sit in the back. You know, do you like contemporary music? Great. Do you like old conservative music? Do you like gospel music? Do you like Negro spirituals? Okay. Isn't there room for everybody? But at some point, we have to make sure that while we continue, and believe me, I am very stoked at the social ministry that we have in this congregation, and the amount of work that we do in outreach and reaching out to those less fortunate. But that's not at the cost of the gospel imperative. And so whether the preaching or teaching or, you know, whatever, isn't there room for everybody at the table? And the groups that are tanking right now are basically saying, you got to do it our way. Our way or the highway. And I'm going, really? What happened to unity and diversity? What happened at there's a place at the table for me? What happened for whosoever believed, whoever receives, to them he gives power to become children of God? Who is going to deny baptism of a child because of the status of their parent? I don't get that. But as we address all of these issues, the thing that we need to hold on to is we do have to learn from the past. And one of the lessons I hope you see is when people force an issue and they draw the line in the sand and they say, you've got to be on this side of the line, just wait a few years. And you're going to find something about that person or that congregation or history that says, don't think I'd have been quite that judgmental there, brother. Because what we're doing, there was a song back in the 60s that I loved, and it said, you've become so heavenly minded, you're no earthly good. I don't think we can become so earthly minded that we're no heavenly good. But I think the Episcopal Church, and I'm very proud to be an Episcopalian, we still support the Episcopal Church. We are one of 10 congregations in the diocese. But a part of that is there's a lot that we have to be proud of. We have a rich history. But a part of our mission forward is we need to reclaim that history. And it needs to be a history that we're proud of, that we can reach out and bring others not into a relationship with the church, but into a relationship with God. You know? We gotta quit preaching church. Jesus didn't preach church. He preached God. Okay, next week, Martin Bayang will be here, for church. You want to have dinner, that's fine. I'm not going to be here to do Bible study, and I don't have time between now and Sunday when I'm leaving to prepare anything for somebody. So we will pick up when we come back. The next set of handouts are over here. And what we're going to look at, I think you'll find this very interesting, is not what does the Bible say about prayer, but what we're actually going to do is we're going to look at the prayers, the text of the prayers that are recorded in the Bible. And what we're going to do with that is to say, you know, this heaping up lofty words and long, lengthy prayers. You'll see biblical prayers are very short and very direct. But the ultimate goal of studying Bible prayer is so oftentimes people say, well, you know, I would be more bold in my prayer if I just knew that my prayer was in God's will. When you study the prayers in the Bible, you begin to learn that there is a method in those prayers that reveals God's will. I think you'll find it very interesting. Handouts are in there. They're sticking up, dated 5/20. So I think you'll find that interesting. Remember, if you miss anything from now through over the summer, if you're leaving, going away, whatever, you can catch us on the web. The handouts are also on the web. So if you're away or miss something, you can download them there. Okay? Hoorah!